All right, y'all ready to start? It's quite a bit of text. I'm going to, first of all, I don't feel as prepared just because I had a sermon to do. Everything takes me so long. I think it's just a matter of getting old or something. But so y'all can help me through these. I think many of you know the story of Samson. I think there's just some interesting analysis we can do, and we'll do that, and we'll break into groups and have fun doing some of those things. You remember where we are here? Let me get my pen going. We're actually now, according to the Bible Project, you know, we're the last of the main judges here to show the corruption. And what you see, at least in this story, is that Samson, there's kind of a downhill trend here where Samson is maybe the worst, according to this. I think we're going to see that, you know, each of these stories has subtleties to it. And we might see that even within Samson's life, it was worse at the end than the beginning. So there was a downward decline even during his life. We'll notice that. So that's what we're doing there. I'm not going to give you the quiz except for one. The one new Hebrew word I want to learn tonight is Lehi. Do anybody know what that means before we dive in? It's not a sugary grape drink. It's not that. You have to be old to understand that joke, Sean.
Yeah, I get it, Marty. I get it.
Yeah.
Sister had one every day.
Yeah, grape or orange or something.
Yeah, grape.
But it's not that. It's not that. Well, it means jawbone. So here are all the words. I think we could just learn a couple more words and we could have the whole class in Hebrew. What do you think? Do we know enough yet? Maybe that'd be a good
idea. No.
Probably not. Anyway, Lehi's jawbone. There's a couple other words we'll look at just out of interest as we go through the text. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this too, except I'll just let you, maybe I'll give you a second to call out each one. Where's Judah? And you might have to go off.
In the sky. Yeah,
where's Simeon? Yeah, absorbed in Judah. Where's Benjamin?
Jay.
No.
No, not Jay.
L.
L, yes, between, yeah. Next to Judah. Where's Dan?
I,
and also where?
G.
And where's Ephraim?
J.
The Pill Country.
Next to Dan.
J. Yep, J. Where's Manasseh? Two letters.
A and C.
Good. And where's Gad?
Okay. Dad is above the K.
No, yeah, it is K. Right. That's
K.
That
character. Oh, it is K? Okay.
And then what's the – so the one below Reuben, where's that? I guess I just told you, right?
Reuben is
E. Yeah, Reuben is E, right. So those are the Transjordan tribes, Manasseh, East Gad, and Reuben. All right, moving on up. Where's this – in this plane here where it's good for vehicles, what would that be?
It's a car.
Issachar, right. Where's Zebulun?
Next to it.
M, that's correct. Asher is?
By the C.
F.
By the C. In?
Naphtali.
Okay, you see, I got all the letters this right. And then Levi absorbed without any land. It's going to seem like we're going backward, but I'd have to go back to chapter 10, which we studied last week, because I think we pointed out that chapter 10, verses 6 through 9, introduces both the story of Jephthah, who had to deal with the Ammonites, and also Samson, who had to deal with the Philistines. And so Israel, verse 6, again did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, the Ashtoreth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab. And notice what he lists last is the gods of Ammon and the gods of the Philistines. Why are those two God's important then in these stories that follow? Well, those are the two nations, right, that were oppressing Israel, one from the east, that the Ammon, and one from the west, the Philistines. So the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the people of Ammon. So we talked about the Ammonites last time. That's the one that Jephthah dealt with, but now he goes on in his next story to talk about Samson, who dealt with the Philistines. All right, group exercise to wake everybody up right away. What I'd like to do is ask you this question. I'd like you to just very quickly, in a couple of minutes, list the contrast between Samson and Jephthah. I think you know enough about them, and that would include the circumstances in their life, the events in their lives, and obviously their character as well. So hang on. So breakout rooms. So I think maybe we'll have five rooms. That's maybe four or five people each. Has everybody got the assignment? List the contrast between the circumstances and demonstrated character of Samson and Jephthah. Give me some idea of how much you know about each story. All right? Ready? Hold on to your seats. One, two, three, go.
Hello.
Hello, hello. I will start with the first one. I'll beat you. Okay? All right. Jephthah came from a non-spiritual family, and Samson came from a spiritual family.
You can say Samson knew his mom and dad, and Jephthah was a what didn't. He didn't live with them. I'll just say that. So did Samson know the law very well? Jephthah seemed to know it pretty well.
Well, that's the contrast to me. If he was set apart to be a Nazirite in the womb, his mother must have followed all the rules, but I don't think he was raised right.
Yeah, exactly. Now,
because he was so carnal.
Yeah.
It's just so physical. And they went along with him. Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem was bad parenting.
Yeah.
And it's like Jephthah kind of grew up with a dysfunctional family and was kicked out. And Samson grew up with a good one and look.
And ended up, yeah, how he was, yeah. Yeah. It seems like Jephthah was, how would I say, he was more of a servant to the people, where Samson was all about himself.
And seemed almost arrogant or flippant, like, get me this.
Right.
And Jephthah seems a little bit more humble.
Yeah.
In leadership. You know, he grew in the.
Yeah.
So Jephthah kept his vow and Samson didn't keep his vow.
And broke his vow, yeah.
That's a good one.
Yep. Yeah. Let's see. Any others?
Well, women weren't involved in Jephthah's life. Samson, I mean, this is very carnal sounding, but he was a skirt chaser, don't you think?
Uh-huh. A bit, yes.
A bit. I mean, come on.
And also, Jephthah kind of did all his battles through, he was a leader and he led men in his battles, where Samson basically did everything himself. He wasn't a leader. And
he did stuff when he got mad. Then
when he got mad, yeah, exactly. Yep. So those were some of the things, I guess. Okay. We're supposed to leave. Oh, go ahead.
Well, Samson committed suicide.
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
Didn't, as far as we know. Jephthah was not captured by the Philistines. He didn't fight them. He fought the Ammonites. But he wasn't captured by the enemy.
Yeah. Samson was.
And he really pawed at them because he went into their cities, you know. Foolish.
Yeah.
Very foolish strategy, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Any others?
Does Samson mention God at all, other than like at the end? Doesn't he finally?
Okay, I guess everybody's back. How about some quick answers? What do you see in contrast? And they're not that many. Maybe you shouldn't take them that long, but I thought it'd be a good warm-up exercise. What'd you come up with?
The Holy Spirit comes upon Samson more often than it does upon Jephthah.
Yeah, great point, Nate. As a matter of fact, that phrase is used 7 times in the book of Judges, that the Spirit of Jehovah, of Yahweh, came upon the person. Samson gets 4 of those 7 in the whole book. I think only once in Jephthah's story, and that's when he is moved to go and pass through all the land of Gilead, I guess, to recruit people. Good one. What else?
Jephthah kept his vow and Samson didn't keep his vow.
Yeah, vows are such a central element, really, in both stories. One, not all that appropriate, really. The other one of Samson's, of course, was appropriate. It was actually given to him by God before he was born, and yet he didn't keep it. On the other hand, Jephthah made one perhaps inappropriately and kept it. And not only that, I keep remembering that phrase, and he spoke all his words before Jehovah. You see that as a consistent record of the way Jephthah lived his life, for better or for worse, imperfectly, of course. What else?
Jephthah came from a wicked family. I'm sorry.
Okay, I heard Teresa and maybe even Brigham or somebody. But anyway, Teresa first. What do you got?
Jephthah had a child. No indication that Samson had children.
Yeah. I mean, you wonder with all the women he had, but in any case, yeah, right. Paul, that's good. Thank you, Paula.
Jephthah came from a wicked family, and it seems that Samson came from a righteous family.
Yeah, I mean, you really see the respect for Jehovah in his parents. We have to assume that his mother knew what a Nazarite vow involved. Of course, that was explained to her. But she must have kept it, right? You just have to believe that she did, which would be an awareness and obedience to the law. But what else about the family, sir? Brigham, were you going to say something about them?
Yeah, sure. Jephthah seems to be an accident and illegitimate, whereas Samson was, eagerly anticipated.
Yeah, and desired late in life, only child, favored, blah, blah, a lot of that. You remember Jephthah, in contrast to Abimelech, was the son of a harlot as opposed to a concubine. So in this case, Samson, extremely opposite, favored, desired child in what seems to be a spiritual family. And Jephthah had none of those advantages. In fact, thrown out of his house, forced to make his way on his own. It's interesting that those two backgrounds led to such opposite characters as well when those go forward. Yeah, those are the main points. Anything else? Any other points you can think of?
Well, to me, Samson was so carnal.
Yeah.
And especially, in the common vernacular, a skirt chaser. I don't think there's anybody in the Bible who interacted with, well, maybe Solomon, but you know what I mean, going from one to another to another.
Yeah, and it's not even just the frequency, it's the power that it seemed to have over it. I mean, you see that in at least 2 stories where he's not even thinking clearly. It's pretty clear his brain isn't working right. We don't know about Jephthah's love life to make a contrast, but he was such a clear thinker, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He could reason, he wanted to negotiate in the various situations, so... Yeah, okay, well, thank you for that. I just wanted to kind of warm us up thinking about the past story, because I think you remember in Hebrews, where we've got our 4 judges listed, that Samson and Jephthah are grouped together by the reversing of the order, as are Gideon and Barak. And they had something in common. They're kind of doubtful, fearful, reluctant approach to the job they've been given. And on the other hand, Samson and Jephthah did not seem to be struggling at all with self-confidence or with courage. In fact, when we meet Jephthah, he's already a mighty man of valor. So there we are. I just want to remind you, I'm going to go ahead and animate this whole chart, that remember we said that the judges likely overlap the time of Eli and maybe even some of Samuel. most of what I could read, and I didn't try to trace the logic myself, puts the reign, or at least the exploits of Samson, those 20 years it says that he judged Israel, somewhere around the time, maybe after the ark was captured by the Philistines. You remember that story? It's when Eli fell over and died and his sons were killed and the ark was captured. Remember all that when they took it into battle? And then that the ark, if you remember, made its way through the various cities of Philistia doing damage wherever it went, smashing down Dagon, knocking his arms off and stuff, his head, as well as afflicting the people and all of that. So maybe during that time that it was making its way through Philistia and finally back into, I forget the name of the guy's house that it ended up with. Maybe during that time that actually that's the things that happened in the book of Judges related to Samson occurred. Don't know, but just don't think about this as some long time before. You can almost match these stories together with the things going on in the time of Eli. All right. A lot of reading. I'm trying to figure out a way to make sure we cover interesting things without maybe reading every single word. Y'all could help me with this. I don't know how many of you have read this in detail before the class. So you're probably raising your hand just to keep me from reading every word, aren't you? But anyway, that's okay. We'll summarize some things. But to start with, I would like to read most of this. Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. So you see, that's a time span, probably part of that overlap. Now, there was a certain man from Zorah, family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Indeed, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now, therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink, not to eat anything unclean. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." You see this kind of preliminary thing. It's not going to be like the end of the oppression, like with Ammon and the Midianites and others we've seen in the past. This was only the beginning, and an incomplete beginning, of course. So the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God." Very awesome. "But I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name." By the way, Manoah will later ask him his name. I don't know why that's so important to them, but it's interesting. She didn't think to and felt bad about it or something. I don't know. "And he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. Now drink no wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.' Then Manoah prayed to God, or to the Lord, and said, 'Oh, my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born.'" Why did Manoah want the guy to come back? Do you have opinions on that? I'm trying to break up the reading, but I don't know the answer either. But any ideas?
Possibly confirmation. I mean,
yeah, that's an idea that he wasn't sure his wife got it right. He didn't really maybe trust her memory or her experience or something. That could be one thing.
It's kind of like Gideon and faith. Show me.
Let's do this again, maybe. Yeah. And it could just be that he had a lot of questions. You see, when the man comes back, look at the last verse on this page. He asks this the man of God that looked like an angel, and turns out was actually. He said, "What will be the boy's rule of life and his work?" So maybe he was looking for more details to understand more of what will his life be like, not just what's the mom going to do until he's born. And what rules will he live by? But maybe he was searching for more information.
Hey, Marty?
Yeah, James.
I just thought about when you read that last part. When someone gives you this kind of explanation, you're wondering what is this child's vocation going to be. It reminds me of John the Baptist.
Yeah, a lot of it does, really, in a way, doesn't it? Because
all this odd things. They say, what is he going to do in life?
Yeah. I mean, even to the point that it says, He's not the deliverer. He shall begin to deliver, right? Is he a forerunner of the deliverance or something like that? And, of course, you've got elderly parents. You've got a miraculous revelation, that he will be born. and so on. So anyway, all good points. And then see, so Manoah, so God listened to the voice of Manoah, so not any disapproval necessarily. And the angel of God came to the woman again. Interesting, he didn't come to Manoah. He came to the woman again. And it's like she had to jump up and run, find him. He's back. This guy's back again. Come find him. As she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. The woman ran in haste and told her husband and said, look, the man who came the other day just now appeared to me. It looks as if they knew, or she knew, he was a prophet, maybe by his demeanor or by his speech or something. But it doesn't seem like it's quite dawned on them yet that this is a miraculous figure. And, of course, I don't think the person, this angel of God, had done a miraculous thing in the appearing to the woman. But I don't know. Anyway, Manoah rose, followed his wife. He came to the man and said, are you the man who spoke to this woman? He said, I am. Manoah said, now let your words come to pass. What will the boy's rule of life and what will be his work? I just want to stop for a second and talk about the Nazarite vow, trying to break this up a little bit. You have to go to number 6. I'll just highlight 3 things that are in there. Wine and similar drink, no razor. And then there's one other one, not go near a dead body, even for your mother or father. One of those 3 is not covered in the angel's language here. Which one? It's the dead body one. And I don't know what to make of that. Later, we're going to see that Samson took the honey out of the body of a dead lion, which might have just been unclean anyway, not just, you know, not violating the Nazarite vow to touch a carcass or a dead thing. Did Samson ever touch any other dead people?
He killed a lot.
Well, yeah, I think he did, yeah. Right, so, I mean, one thought is maybe that part of the Nazarite vow was just not going to be appropriate or something. And that is, in his role as a deliverer and slayer of thousands, right, that it might be too difficult. I don't know, that could be that. Some people say, no, you should have done all 3, and so the getting the honey out of the line was a violation of the vow, along with the other things. In fact, it seemed like he was in the vineyard somehow when that was happening. That's not a good sign either. But anyway, that's the Nazarite vow. Any other, anybody want to say anything about that?
Well, Marty, part of that, I mean, you know, with the numbers, it seems like it's a time, right? A separation. Whereas with Samson, it was to be for his whole life.
Yeah, a lot of differences. I didn't put the whole text, but if you keep on reading in Numbers chapter 6, you'll see that it was temporary. That's one thing. You decided to do it. Samson didn't decide. It was given to him before he was born. You decided when it would end, and there was quite a ceremony to end the vow, right? Some sacrifices and so on. And actually, you would cut your hair to represent the end of the period of this dedication or I guess a sacrifice. Special living, I guess, to God. Other than that, I don't quite understand the vow. I mean, what did you do during the time you weren't cutting your hair or drinking any wine or anything? Was it just that sacrifice, or was there some other activity involved? But it was special, and so it was different for Samuel. But I think we might say not only different, but might be more absolute or something. Something that would have been temporary for others. This was his life. You know what I mean? And so it wasn't like just because he didn't decide to do it, it was given to him. I think it was more serious and more important. Anyway. So the angel of the Lord came to Manoah. The angel of the Lord said to Manoah, of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. He kind of said, listen to what she told you. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, or eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you, and we'll prepare a young goat for you. See, I still think that they think he's a man of God, a prophet, and they should show hospitality. The angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you today may, I will not eat your food. But if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to Yahweh, to the Lord. For Manoah didn't know he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel, Lord, what is your name? That when your words come to pass, we may honor you. Interesting. The angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? A lot of interesting in that word. It reminds us of, what is it, Isaiah 9, where, you know, all those names of God are listed, including Wonderful Counselor. It doesn't necessarily mean his name is actually wonderful, but I believe it describes his character and, of course, what he's about to do. As a matter of fact, the root of this word and the root of that word, there are different parts of speech, but it's really the same word. And so maybe he's leaning forward to say, yes, I'm about to do something that will show you how wonderful or awesome or surprising or something I am. Of course, I think really referring to the nature of God. So Manoah took the young goat, verse 19, with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to the Lord. And he did a, and he, that apparently the angel, did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. When the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel of Yahweh. And Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die because we've seen God. I like this part. And I could just imagine the tone of her voice where she says, Manoah, you know, and just, you're not thinking clearly. If the Lord desired to kill us, he wouldn't have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have told us such things as these at this time. She's kind of saying, I don't think we're going to die until at least we've had a son. And, you know, so it's kind of an interesting point she makes that he had kind of overlooked. So the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. Now, that word Samson, most people say it's kind of a root that has to do with sun or sunlight. But there's other another possible root, and then Josephus said this anyway, that it really means strong or daring one, which would fit. But somehow that name is important. And anyway, again that phrase, called his name. I think we saw that earlier. Remember, I think it was Abimelech, right? He didn't say his name was. It was like there's something special about that assignment. The child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And here we are, number one. The Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Mahaneh, which means the camp of. There's another word we could have put on the vocabulary, but Mahaneh, Dan, the camp of Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol, which we're not sure exactly where those places are. But here's somebody's idea of where they might be. You see in the map right here. There's these two places, and you need to understand that Ekron and Gath and over to what farther over here, Gaza and other, those are some of the cities, capital cities of the Philistines. So it's probably right down through here was the border between Philistia and Israel. And probably it was not that bright of a line as I've drawn. It's probably that they were kind of, you know, people were living on one end or the other. In fact, I don't know where the Valley of Sorek is, but most likely it's kind of in the same area as Samson's hometown. So you see the Philistines and the Israelites were kind of intertwined and overlapping. And, you know, this is, of course, in the southwest corner. You see down here where the Philistine territory is in this area here. And remember, we talked about Judah and Benjamin in here. And then, of course, Dan stuck over here over where the Philistines are. Okay. I pause briefly. Anybody? Okay, so there's his birth and the promises about him. He would begin to deliver Israel. It's interesting, it seems as if he grew, and this might remind you another passage too about he grew in wisdom and stature or something. The Spirit of the Lord came to, you know, began to move him. It's almost like he was Samson himself was looking for how he could fulfill his role to begin to deliver Israel. That's a theory. Let's look for that in the text. So Samson went down to Timnah, and he saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of Philistines. There, now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he just wanted to marry a Philistine per se. You can look at that reference in Exodus, and there was a process by which a woman could be brought in and made a wife, even if she was not among the Israelites, and it could have been that. And the father could do that, purchase the woman from her family for his son, and there was some regulation there in Exodus about what they could or couldn't do once he had done that. They had to take care of her. If he married somebody else, she still had to be cared for and supported and things like that. So that, all I'm just saying is it's not necessarily that he was, well, maybe, that he was just attracted to a woman there and he wanted her for his wife just like that. That's the way I usually have thought of it. It may not be so. Then his father and mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of brethren or among my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. And that does sound like an only child to me. I don't know. Anyway. But his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. For at that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Now, in the New King James, he is capitalized. I don't think they're capitalized in Hebrew. So that don't pay attention to the capital H here. But who do you think the he is in that passage? And I guess I'm really, I guess we will all say we don't know for sure. Maybe you won't. Maybe you know for sure. But there's really two ways to take that. It could be, and by the way, I should just add one other thing. You know that in a lot of languages, the verb actually carries the, you know, the number and the gender and stuff of the pronoun that it goes with. And that's true in Hebrew too. But on occasion, for emphasis, sometimes a pronoun is put in place, and that's the case here. So in the way this is written, this he is intended to be by emphasis, right? So so if it was just seeking, it could be Jehovah. But what's another possibility? There's really only one other.
Samson.
It could have been Samson. And if really, if we go back to the previous chart, remember, it's in the context, and unfortunately it's on two different pages, but pretty close. The Spirit of the Lord began to move him. There's something happening in Samson's thinking, I guess. And so it could be that it was from the Lord, that Spirit we just talked about, and that perhaps Samson was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. For at that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Somebody argue with me, but that's a possibility, isn't it? I don't know. What argue against that point? I don't know.
Samson doesn't seem smart enough to think like that.
So, well,
that's what I was thinking, saying Samson has the foresight that he's going to create this relationship so he can go and get the Philistine.
Well, I need the class to be interesting. So I'm proposing a theory, and we're going to try to run with that theory till we just run out of gas, okay?
Samson would appreciate that, Martin.
Yeah, I know. So a little bit of a spoiler alert here. We'll find the four cases where the Spirit of the Lord moves upon him. Once is just when he kills the lion, of all things. But we'll also notice when that Spirit stops. Look for when, so it seemed like up to that point, a lot of things happened. And, you know, it looks like Samson, well, it's not look like, he says he's getting revenge, right? It's not like it's appearance. But for sure, these circumstances in his life are making occasions for him to do terrible things to the Philistines, to judge them, to destroy them. And by the way, in the story, you'll see they illustrate their own character when they burned down his wife's father's house, you know, and all that, as for what Samson did. But anyway, so it isn't that they didn't kind of deserve some of that from the standpoint of vengeance. But anyway, here it's a possibility. There's a couple of commentators that pretty respected that, believe that's the intent of that. And what we're seeing, if that's true, is we're seeing Samson, who is a little bit more clever than we often think, Mike, right? But we're going to see that decline over time, yeah. You know, and you'll see even there's a phrase, it almost seems to divide Samson's life into two parts. You'll see that as we go through.
And he is mentioned in the Heroes of Faith. So
find that out. There's something.
I'm sorry. I'm a spoiler. But
that's
he
right.
is.
No, that's right. Right. Yeah. And so there's something that we should admire about. So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards. Catch that, of Timnah. What was he doing there? And to his surprise, a young lion, maybe that's just the way the road went. Young lion came roaring against him, and the Spirit of the Lord, there's number two, came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand, no weapon. He didn't tell his father or mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman. Now, this is interesting. You notice when he first meets her, What kind of relationship did they have? Right? And now, for the first time, what kind of relationship did they have? He actually talked to her, right? And not only that, see, now I'm kind of supporting my theory a little bit here. He actually liked her, right? So it's kind of interesting. Did he say that she pleased him well before? Yes, he did, right up here. Pleases me well. But now he's actually talked with her, so I don't quite get that. But it does support the theory that this idea of going and just seeing somebody and saying, yeah, let's do the wife thing, and that'll create an occasion. That's a possibility. Anyway, he talked with her, and she pleased him well. After some time, when he returned to get her, weeks or so later, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. And he took some of it and went along and eating. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate, but he did not tell them that he'd taken honey out of the carcass of the lion, probably because might have been unsanitary, but probably not. The thought here is that it wasn't a skeleton of a lion, that it probably just had been a carcass in the desert and just dried out. So it had skin and everything. It would have been just like the trunk of a tree or something where bees might put a hive in honey. But in any case, it was out of a dead animal, so it might not have been ceremonially clean for them. But he didn't tell them in any case. So verse 10, his father went down to the woman. Samson gave a feast there, for young men used to do so. That's another one of those weird phrases that indicates the author is sometime later looking back at the way things used to be or still are to this day. You know, we're going to see some other things about the names there, that the name is still called that, or that fountain of the jawbone or whatever fountain of the caller or the seeker or something is still there to this day. So this is interesting here. What's going on here? When they saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. What does that mean? That is, these are the people, I guess, at Timnah, the Philistines. Is there anything? I don't know. Could it be that they saw he was by himself and didn't have any, groomsmen? And so they got 30 companions to fill in. You know, one of them is going to be his best man and end up with the wife, you know, before the story's over. But in any case, I don't know if that means they just saw he was by himself. It's hard to believe at this point that they thought he was dangerous, but I don't know. But they brought 30 companions. I don't know what that means. But it could just mean they saw he needed companions. But Samson said to them, so Mike, here's this. Is this clever or not? What's the point of telling the riddle here and making it a bet that has to do with a bunch of money that's going to make them, in fact, they say later, you're going to make us impoverished, you know, over this joke if you don't get this answer out of it. So to take what is ours is what they say here. So I think he's working this potentially. Let me pose a riddle. If you can correctly solve and explain to me within 7 days of the feast, I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. Did he have those already? I mean, what? Maybe he thought he wasn't going to lose. That's probably right. Yeah. There's no way I'm going to lose this. And they said to him, pose your riddle. We can hear it. He said to them, out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. He even rhymed it in English, Mike. Isn't that clever?
Pretty good.
I remember when I was studying this as a kid, I was thinking, this is Cassius Clay Muhammad Ali. Remember him?
Exactly.
He's a float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Sting like a bee.
Yeah. For 3 days, they couldn't explain the riddle, but it came to pass on the seventh day, they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we'll burn you in your father's house with fire. So there's a, have you invited us in order to take what's ours? Is that not so? So Samson's wife wept on him and said, you only hate me, you don't love me. You have posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me. And he said to her, look, I've not explained it to my father or mother, so should I explain it to you? She had wept on him the 7 days while the feast lasted. Now, that's a little puzzling because it was 3 days they struggled to explain the riddle. And it was on the seventh day that they came to her and said, we're going to burn your house down. I think the best explanation is that they've been working on her and she'd been working on him for probably the whole time. But it just got escalated, you know, the stakes and the threats and the weeping and whatever else she did probably got worse until finally the last day, while their feast lasted, because she pressed him so much, he explained the riddle. And so they were able to come back and said, what's sweeter than honey? What's stronger than a lion? He said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. So you see, there's one of these rap contests going back and forth, right? So they answer the riddle and he raps back and says, here's how you got it. Anyway. And then, number three, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. He went down to Ascalon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, gave the changes of clothing to those who explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused and he went back up to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been the best man. I'm not sure. Yes, I wasn't going to show this map. This is a map from another period of time, but you can see where he went. This is where he got the garments, right? And all this stuff was happening up here at Timnah. This is from another time. Pay no attention to the red arrows, but you see how the Philistine territory and Judah are close together there. So that's where he got them, 30, and brought them back. I don't guess that upset. And didn't finish. And then so his anger was aroused. He went back to his father's house. So he's mad. He didn't go to his wife. And Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his best man, obviously one of the Philistines who had filled in that role. I don't think the people of Timnah were upset about the garments or where they got them from, right? That was from another city. So something else has to happen to make them angry. After a while, in time of the wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat, and he said, let me go into my wife, into her room. And that literally means in her, you know, her sleeping chamber. That's the idea. But her father wouldn't let him go in, or would not permit him. Her father said, I really thought that you had thoroughly hated her, though, so therefore I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead. Samson said to them, this time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them. And then Samson went and caught 300 foxes. He took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail. Anyway, he burned their fields. Did the Spirit of Jehovah come upon him to do that? No, it doesn't seem to have been the, and really, anyway, no, it didn't. The Philistines now, this did hurt them, said, who has done this? Verse 6. And they answered, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite. Interesting. Is he really the son-in-law? He gave his wife away, but I can't explain that. But anyway, you remember that Samson guy that, you know, at that wedding and the 30 garments and everything. Because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. So the Philistine came up and burned her and her father with fire. That's an odd response. And then that made him more angry. And since you would do this thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you. After that, I will cease. So he attacked him hip and thigh with a great slaughter. And he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Edom. Hip and thigh is some type of a euphemism, but I think it just means violently. I think it means he tore him up. I think that's the idea of that phrase. I think I meant to say idiom, not euphemism, but anyway, an idiom. Okay, so that starts more of an escalation. So you see what's happening here. This occasion that began with just seeing a woman and asking to get her for his wife has escalated with event after event until finally it's going to come to a head in this story. The Philistines went up, encamped in Judah, deployed themselves against Lehi, which we now know what that means. It means cheek or jawbone. And by the way, it probably got the name because of what happened. But in the telling of the story, the writer just uses the name of that place, even though it got the name after the event. And the men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? The men of who? Of Judah. That's where he was. And so the Philistine answered, we've come up to arrest Samson, to do to him as he has done to us. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Edom and said to Samson, do you not know the Philistines rule over us? What is this you've done to us? So they're mad at him as instead of being counting on him as a deliverer. By the way, another contrast with Jephthah, right? And as they sought Jephthah out as a deliverer, here in this case, they rejected Samson, who was a deliverer. And actually, in the end, were not interested at all in having him around. They were afraid of what might happen to them if he led them. And he said to them, as they did to me, so I've done to them. They said, "What? Why?" And they said, but they said to him, "We've come down to arrest you that we may deliver you to the hands of the Philistines." And Samson said, "Swear to me you will not kill me yourselves." Somehow he knows what's going to happen. So they spoke, saying, "No, we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you." And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Okay, here it is. This is it. The fourth time, the last time, in fact, that the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. The ropes that were on his arms became like flax, that is, burned with fire. His bonds were broken loose from his hands. Indication is that that he didn't kill all 1,000 men in one incident. And one theory is that when he comes out and he's bound with those ropes and he just throws them off. Sorry, I hope that you're still there. I got to move my, sorry, system problem. We're done. I'm fixed. When they saw him break those bonds, that they all were frightened and began running. And it appears that what he had to do was chase them down to some extent and kill them in groups. Heaps upon heaps is one of the things he says would almost suggest groups of slaughter along the way. But he found the fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. And then he said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've slain 1,000 men. And it was so, when he finished speaking, that he threw the jawbone from his hand. He called the place Ramath Lehi, which is the height of the jawbone, or jawbone heights, I guess it would be. And he became very thirsty, cried out to the Lord, and said, "You've given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. Now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" Do you sense that Samson knows God's doing this through him in what he says there? I'm still trying to drive my car without any gas in it on my theory, okay? But I do think that it's possible that we could look at these events. Surely Samson's character for revenge and all of that is showing through. But still, I think he knows he's acting on the Spirit of Jehovah and certainly empowered by him. And so, anyway, he was thirsty. God split the hollow place. And water came out and he drank and his spirit returned and he revived. Therefore, he called its name En-Hakkor, or whatever that, how you pronounce that, which means the fountain of one calling, which is in Lehi to this day. And there's again the author's voice, isn't it? Saying it's still there in Lehi to this day. And now here's an interesting point. Verse 20. And he judged Israel 20 years in the days of Philistines. What would you think would be the next verse would be about? Aaron?
That he died.
Yeah, or, right, if I was reading this book and I came to that, because I've seen this before, almost every time. And he judged Israel for 10 years, and he judged Israel for, what do I think the next verse will be is that there's another judge, right? Or Israel again did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. In other words, I would think it would be a new story beginning. Is that possible? There is a new story about to begin here that's different. How am I doing with my car that's out of gas? I don't know. But, anyway, so it does, and by the way, we've had our four, the Spirit of Jehovah doesn't have a role anymore. We've gotten to this point, and he's done damage to the Philistines in the thousands. And by the way, he's killing men of war, not just men and women in the temple. He's actually helping in judgment against the Philistines, beginning, as the angel said earlier, beginning to deliver Israel. Okay.
Well, that's a difference too. Jephthah's leading other men. Samson's
solo, right?
Solo, yeah. He's killing them on his own.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I just want to say a little bit about that too. I thought about that too. Not about the so well because he's so well. Was Samson like? Was he unbelievable? Well, the Gaza story is going to be like the same thing. Was he like a Superman? Do you know what I mean? If you had been there and watched what he was doing, would there have been any doubt that what he did was a miraculous thing? The 1,000 men? I mean, not to mention the fountain and all that.
Remember, Shamgar killed 600 with an ox goad, wasn't it? And
yes.
They were Philistines.
Yes.
I don't know.
Was it all in one battle?
I don't know.
Nate, you drew the cartoons. Was it all in one battle with Shamgar?
Well, carrying the gates on his back?
Yeah, that
took him a lot.
Yeah.
Took a lot.
Go ahead, Nate. What do you think?
I think it took him a lot, yeah. It's more fun that way. It gives me more to do.
I think he just got another one.
Yeah, spread it out over time. Yeah, enjoy the ride and all that. Yeah, but, you know, yeah, when we get to this, you just look at Samson, and you just see he's almost, it's like Superman. I mean, I think some of the superheroes have had to come from some of these kind of stories. By himself, even his own people don't believe in him. They try to, like the good cops and Superman, they don't know what they're doing. They don't even like Superman or Batman or those guys. Anyway, so you know the story about Gaza. Only interesting point I would make is why didn't they guard the gate, you know, during the night? And I think they figured he would just stay the whole night with the harlot there. And that he wouldn't get up till the morning. And they also probably figured the gates were locked, so what's the worry, you know? But anyway, so he carried the gates. So I remember I read Hebron, how far away it was, 9 miles maybe, I think. Maybe it looks like more than that on the chart. It maybe looks more like 30 or 40 maybe. But anyway, but there's also a hill that you go up and you kind of see the mountains of where Hebron is. And maybe he just carried the top of the hill. And it's about, it's about a mile or so, a couple miles walk uphill, of course, when you're not carrying a gate on your shoulders. So that's okay. So everybody's familiar with that story. Paul.
Marty, my footnote says it's 38 miles. I don't know.
Yeah, that looks like what it is on this scale. If it's the whole way. Now, what it says is he took the doors to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. You see that? So it could be that right outside Gaza, there's a mountain range where you get up there, and from there you can kind of see Hebron from there, and that's where it is. Either way, I mean, he took the whole gate up.
But it's interesting, too. He also pulled out the gate post.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
And carried it all up. I mean, that's...
Yeah, it mentions two pieces of it, the doors and the post, all in there, yeah. Okay. I'm conscious of the time, and I want to do an exercise. And I guess you all know the story of Delilah, right? I think maybe of all the stories, we probably know those details. He loved a woman. Now, here's the thing where's the Spirit of Jehovah? It's not going to be mentioned again. None of what he does is in that. And in this case, it doesn't appear there's any connection with seeking an occasion against the Philistines. In fact, just the opposite happens, as you know. And so in this attempt, you know, to find out his secret, he gives her three false reasons, you know, for his strength. And it probably reflects the fact that Philistines probably thought he had a magic stone, you know, or he had, I don't know, what's the opposite of kryptonite? Or he had some kind of, you know, he ate his spinach and then he turned it into, you know, Superman or something. I guess they thought there must be something they could discover that that made him strong. Not really thinking that had to do more with his relationship with God and God's support of him, which is what departed. And in fact, where does it say? I think we'll find it. Now, the Spirit didn't come upon him, just the opposite happened. You know, this is when she finally talked it out of him, got the information. And it says right here, the Lord departed. He didn't know that the Lord departed from him. You see, that's what the secret of his strength was. And when the Lord is not with him, then he is easy prey. And so terrible things happen. And he's put in bronze fetters, and he's made to grind in the prison, which is the lowliest of service things, which without his eyes is probably maybe about all he could do. And so he was there, and then the Lord's gathered in the in their temple to Dagon, and they brought him in as a kind of a spectacle. And it seemed like there's even a phrase in there where I have to read it through to find it, but it says they were all just looking at it. That was kind of what he was there for. When they saw him, I guess is the phrase here. Anyway, when they saw him, they praised their God and so on. And so the temple apparently maybe was built this way, maybe columns around the outside, and then in the middle, maybe two columns that all the cross beams, you know, came in to support the roof. That makes sense. So those two things in the middle were like in the middle of the room, and then that let the whole room be open except for those two columns. I'm just guessing here because it appears that, yes.
They have excavated a Philistine temple that has two columns in the middle.
There you go. And so instead of one column, and I'm thinking if you had one, it'd be hard to get the beams all on one, but two columns makes it easier, you know, to get the beams all the way around. And so he asked for one of the servants there to take him and put him there, and so he can press those beams apart and the temple falls down. And Samson called to the Lord, saying, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one on his right, the other on his left. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the Lord's and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. And his brothers and all his father's household came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol, which is where he was from, in the tomb of his father, Manoah, apparently who was dead. And again, it mentions, again, he judged Israel for 20 years. So there's like an echo of that. I usually go a little bit longer. I have one more group assignment. There's a question that is often asked, and that is why so much of the text of Judges and why so many interesting details, including the names of people and the names of places and details about the events, about like foxes and you know, the lion and the honey and all those things. Why so much detail is dedicated? Why is so much detail dedicated to the story of Samson, the history of Samson? Given he was a loner, he didn't really deliver Israel. He began to deliver Israel from the Philistines. You think of him as a minor character, living really during the time of the other events like the ark being captured and other things which maybe seem more significant. Why so much emphasis on Samson's life? And there is a thought that in some ways, Samson is in parallel somehow with the entire history of Israel and their relationship with God. What I'd like to do is do the groups right quick, and y'all work really fast, and come up with three or four things in which the events and circumstances of Samson's life, and even before his life, are parallel to the nation of Israel and its history. Even the history that comes to pass after Samson, I mean. You know, the whole history. Everybody got the assignment? Easy? Okay, well,
This one's hard.
I'm not quick to this, but I'll get there quickly. Same groups? Y'all like your groups okay? Too late anyway. Aaron, I'll put you in another group if you want. You're okay? Okay. All right.
Now you're ready.
What happened to Eric?
So, it was a child of promise.
Yep.
Selected as the holy nation.
Right.
God chosen, and he was chosen to be.
To be set apart based on a law
that
he did not keep. He played the harlot with other nations. was taken into captivity because of his wickedness. He cried out to the Lord, and the Lord delivered him.
Yeah.
And every woman or pagan tried to pull him away from the Lord. I mean, every incident. Right?
Boom, we win.
Okay, right there. What was hard about that? Okay.
You're too late.
Marty, too late. This group's already done.
All right. Yeah, these group activities at the end go way faster than the ones at the beginning.
This one was easier.
No, you sit right here. You can say hello.
Hey,
hi.
How are you?
Say, not so good. I got in trouble.
That happens.
That happens.
Jumping on the furniture.
That happens.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I'm doing really good.
Good.
Okay. Y'all can go play, but please be quiet.
We're going to
I don't know what you're saying. Let's say what this other is. Hey.
Are you all doing that study with Dustin and Hannah with the kids?
No.
We finished when we finished the Beatitudes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a little shorter. Yeah, we started it when we weren't doing any.
Right. Nobody was doing anything.
Normal school. Now we're back to normal school, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
See y'all in the big group.
Okay. We'll see there. Well, we have 52 seconds.
I enjoyed being with you all.
It's been a pleasure.
Marty, I want to suggest something about the Spirit of the Lord coming on him when you get a chance.
Yeah, well, go ahead. Do it. Do that. Well, let's see. Wait. I'm not sure everybody's back yet. Yeah, they are. It's time's up. So everybody's here. Yes, please do.
It's interesting. The Spirit of the Lord moved Bezalel and Uri to be able to have skills in embroidery and carpentry and goldsmithing and all kinds of things. And I kind of think of the strength of Samson as something like the gifts of the Holy Spirit in the New Testament that enabled people to do some things that did not necessarily mean that they had great character. The Corinthians had those gifts, but they were sure lacking in love.
Right. And, it's interesting that his strength, that's an interesting point, because his strength did seem to enable him to do things that, it doesn't appear to accomplish the, God's will, like the gates of Gaza. What was that about, as far as he saved himself, I guess. But, he did have that strength, but it didn't mean his character was great. But anyway, back to my theory, it does seem like that Spirit of God moving him was characteristic of the first part of his life and less at the end until the very end. All right, I'm done teaching. Y'all finish out by explaining how Samson's life was in many ways a kind of a, if you think it was, a shadow or a miniature or representative or parallel, at least, to the nation of Israel. What did you come up with?
So Israel, just like Samson, has a lot of potential, but it eventually ends up playing the harlot, as it says, and becoming rebellious.
And losing the potential strength that they had, yeah. Other things, yeah, good.
Child of promise, just as Isaac was a child of promise. He was set apart because of a holy law. He was taken into captivity when he played the harlot with other nations, cried out to God, and God heard him, and I guess it was a deliverance in the end.
Yeah. So would we say that the nation of Israel was chosen before they were born? You know? Yeah, I mean, and...
Yep.
Yeah, and were they to be somehow special, dedicated to God, with special laws that other people maybe didn't have to obey, that kind of thing? All of that set out, you know, at the beginning in God's plan. Wait a minute, I'm teaching again. I don't want to do this. What else?
God rescued them again and again when they didn't deserve it.
Right.
I think sometimes Israel did, they tried to do something not realizing God had departed from them.
Hmm.
And then they would, you know, we're talking about the ark. That's one of the reasons why.
Yeah, good illustration, yeah.
And so, you know, when that's happened a lot of times when they would go and decide to do something and didn't realize it, and bad things happen after that.
Yeah.
Another thing, Marty. The Israelites were tricked a lot, just like Delilah kept teasing and tricking, and, you know, he kept falling back into the same thing.
Yeah, and tricked by the nations around them, right? Yeah. By their neighbors, by the ones they lived with, tempted by more carnal things, of course, than their dedication to the Lord. I just think about Samson, I'm going to do it anyway, as the Superman that he was, and imagine Israel, what they could have been. And actually, I have a slide, but I'm not going to go to the trouble to share my screen. It's really from, I think, Joshua's speech near the end. He said, one man will put to flight 1,000. You remember that verse? And really interesting, the numbers are almost exactly the same. Joshua was saying, this is what you can do. God's already shown you his power in the past, he says in that text. But he said, one man will put to flight 1,000. And that's exactly what Samson did, literally, as one man. And I think God's promise was, you have this enormous potential to have undefeatable, is that a word? Strength, you know, and to do, and of course they did on occasion do things that were seemed that were supernatural, that, you know, and yet they lost that, you know, ability because of their unfaithfulness to their vows, to the covenant that they had made. Which is exactly what happened in Samson's case. Yeah. So great potential lost. And so maybe that's an answer for why Samson gets so much press. It could be that at the time of the writing, the memory of the Philistines was still strong, and maybe that was an important piece of history they need to understand. I don't know. Go ahead, David.
Well, you could almost say in Samson's case, he began to overthrow the Philistines, but he didn't finish the job on his own. His personal failings prevented him from doing that. But there was one who came later who actually did drive out the Philistines and conquer them the way that God maybe intended.
Exactly.
To be done.
And you could even add to that his own destruction, again, looking way forward to the history or the destruction of Israel, was kind of somehow instrumental in bringing about God's plan, you know.
Right. So, and they're destroyed temples in both cases, too.
Yeah, there you go. Didn't rebuild one in 3 days, but still. Yeah. All right. We've gone a little bit over, but not as much as I thought we might. Thank you for participating and helping me during the class. So we have the two unpleasant stories left, two more lessons. Next week and the following week. So I think a couple of chapters each. I can't remember. But we'll talk about those next time. And I'm not the host, so I can log off and y'all can keep visiting if you want, or we can just visit. So I'm done.
I have a question / comment.
Oh, no, not another one.
Yeah. It just seems like like Samson's life is, I feel like, what most men want their life to be like. It's women, it's power, it's reaction when you have anger to, you know, ability to figure things out with your fists and the jawbone of a donkey or whatever's close enough.
Another weird weapon in Judges, as right. You know.
But I mean, it does seem like that's.
Yeah, it's the macho picture, isn't it? Yeah.
And
I want people to be afraid of me, and I want to make sure that if anything harms me, I take vengeance in, you know, sevenfold or whatever Lamech said, you know, so nobody messes with me again. I think that's a lot of our culture is you defend your manhood with violence or threats or, yeah, temper for sure. Temper keeps other people off guard and so on, yeah.
Yeah, when we look in Hebrews 11, like we kind of have a little, we have to squint to look at Samson and go, okay, Samson was one of those faithful in Hebrews 11. It doesn't seem like it because we know that many of his actions just were not good, were wrong. I don't know. It just seems to be a pretty clear picture that not the attitude of Samson that seemed to be his greatest feature, I guess.
Well, like Gideon, you know, you could read that text and it says, you know, time will fail to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. And then who, and then the next series of phrases seem to indicate the things that the Hebrew writer is pointing to that we should think about. They put to flight armies of the aliens. Out of weakness became strong. Whatever those things are, maybe those are the elements that are supposed to be our example. Or the sense to which these witnesses testify to us, we can do it. You know, we can endure.
When Samson did trust God at the end there, he accomplished God's purpose.
Right.
So he died. He died in faith.
Yes, that's a good point. In some ways, accomplished more in that one act, the way the writer puts it, than he had up to that point in time. Yeah, one of the themes of Judges is that it has to be that God uses imperfect men in his plan. And I don't mean like with little flaws. I'm talking about, you know, and in talking to the high school class, I don't know what all some of them have dealt with in their life, people that have disappointed them, people that have hurt them. But it's important to know that God's working a plan for them and he's asking them to do the right thing and not to be surprised at the imperfections of people around them who ought to be more better characters than they are.